And I derived for you the electric black hole solution and also discussed the magnetic black hole solution. So I got a bit of grief from Callum afterwards for not deriving it, and I said I thought I'd probably thrown enough out there as it was for one lecture. But you can actually relate it to the electric black hole solution via one of those duality type of transformations. The difference here is that you get powers of the scalar field coming in. So typically, if you, you know, when you have black hole solutions with gauge fields, whether they be sort of normal, like one-form gauge fields or P-form gauge fields, there's usually, if you look at the equations of motion, you can often find this discrete transformation that relates electric and magnetic solutions. But since I hadn't written down the equations of motion, I just derived for you the action, I didn't really see how I could realistically do that in the time that was left. So what I want to do today is to talk a little bit about stability of some of these solutions, some of the Kaluza-Klein type of solutions. And part of this is to get across to you that different things can happen once you have extra dimensions. Gravity can actually do some unexpected or surprising things. Also, I think it's good to see something of perturbation theory. I mean, I'm not entirely sure what you'll be covering or people who decide to do the numerical relativity course will be covering, but it's always useful to, I mean, I'm sure there'll be a little bit of perturbation theory in there. And also because it actually helps if we want to discuss degrees of freedom in gravity in different numbers of dimensions. So typically, if you want to think of gravity or the graviton as a particle, then what you're actually doing is looking at a wave equation. So I wanted to say a little bit about perturbation theory, but around a general background. Only done it around flat so far, for those that have done it? Around the flat background, right. So we'll just see how it changes when you've got curvature, you know, if you're doing it on a curve manifold. And then I just want to apply that discussion, not in gory detail, but at least to discuss one of the instabilities of one of those Kaluza-Klein black strings. So, if you like, perturbation theory. So it's actually pretty useful to be able to do perturbation theory in gravity. Normally, when you're doing general relativity, if you have an exact solution, you've imposed an awful lot of symmetry. And so what you're describing is not actually that physically realistic. However, because again, bang it home, the nonlinearity of gravity makes it difficult to write down anything but rather special solutions in a nice closed form. So it's a fairly common technique. You find a background which just gets most of what you're looking for right. For example, with a star, it is essentially spherical. It's probably rotating, but it is more or less vacuum outside. So it's a good approximation to use a Kerr or a Schwarzschild solution. And then you can do perturbation theory around that to start trying to describe a more realistic situation. So often, the cases in which we want to solve for gravitational field equations, the system is, broadly speaking, quite symmetric, but with more detail, which is painted on at a sort of sub-leading order. So you've seen, for those of you doing cosmology will have seen this, Friedman-Robertson-Walker universe is incredibly special. It has one free metric function, the scale factor. But if you want to actually describe the universe we live in, you have to do perturbation theory. So you have to perturb around that background, and that's where you start seeing all the structure. So that's where you sort of get into the microwave background fluctuations and also structure formation. So in GR, of course, although we want to actually perturb the manifold and we want to look at the perturbation of Einstein's equations. I'm just going to PT for perturbation theory. So the idea is that you're going to take some background solution that you know. And now, just to be annoying, it is conventional to use HAB for the first fundamental form. It's also, unfortunately, conventional to use HAB for the perturbation in the metric. So that's the idea. You change the metric a little bit and you see what the equations of motion are. So let's just blaze ahead and see what the equations of motion are and then worry about whether what we actually wrote down in the first place makes sense or what we need to do to make it make sense. Right, so what we have to do then is we have to find the variation of the Einstein equations, and this time I'm going to do it in the sort of gory detail, as in going via the Levi-Civita symbols, but I'm going to use those normal coordinates. So in normal coordinates, remember, the derivative of the background is going to be zero, but of course second derivatives are not necessarily zero. So I only pick up a variation of the metric when I've taken the derivative, and then using the fact these are normal coordinates, comma is semicolon, so I put that all the way through. That expression is now covariant, and so that's what the actual variation of the connection is. So I could write this as so that's my connection. And then I want to look at a variation of the, yep, normal coordinates. So I'm going to be full of abbreviations here, so keep on your toes. That's just indicating the method I've used, which has enabled me to just write it down straight away, okay? Rather than having to vary, you know, and keep all the derivatives of G and then pull them together to form a gamma symbol to make those covariant derivatives. But you can do that if you want, if you have a few spare minutes or what have you. So, again, if I think about this using my the normal coordinates, we'd already derived what delta RAB was. So we did that when we were looking at the action principle for gravity.
And so I can now simply input what I've just calculated for the variation of the connection.
It's going to be a bit of a long expression, but you should be used to that by now. So that's what I get for the variation of my Ricci. But what I'm sort of seeing here is that I've got like a sort of partial divergence here, in that I've got a sort of C contraction of this derivative with, you know, the H perturbation, but there's another derivative in between. So what I want to do is to flip the order of both of these derivatives, because I have a sort of feeling that that might help with drawing terms together. So if I use the Riemann identity, then I can swap differentiation, the order of differentiation, at the price of introducing some Riemann terms. Check I've got the right signs there. Yeah. So remember the Riemann identity. Says that if you have a commutator of derivatives, you get the Riemann tensor. In fact, that was how we defined the Riemann tensor in the first place, geometrically. We said, you know, we defined it in terms of its action on a vector. So you had sort of basically an anti-symmetrized covariant derivative acting on a vector gave you the Riemann tensor. Here you're acting on, a mixed tensor here, so you have to have a Riemann for each free index, loosely speaking. And the index you're replacing is always the first one, and the commutator indices are the last two. Yep. Oh, yep. So it should be CA there. I think I've not transported that B. Yep. I replaced the C, and I just did. That was what I. So to remember it, it's like the two derivatives that you're anti-symmetrizing, CA, you put those at the end. I don't know if you noticed when I was writing it down, but that was the first thing I did. I put those two indices right at the end. Then the index I'm replacing, the first one I was replacing, C, that was the one that went in the first slot. And then you have to sum over that for the second slot. So you replace the index, put it in the first slot, and then that just leaves you summing over with the second slot. So I just did that one at a time. So I can now use that to flip. I mean, you can see that this one here is the Ricci, right? That's just RAD. And I can use that to flip the order of both of those derivatives. So the first one there is going to give me So that's the first term. Then the second one is the same as the first, but with A and B swapped. Then I have minus the wave operator of HAB and minus grad A grad B of H, the trace of H. So what you see is that I have the term that I wanted, which is the wave operator acting on H. I've got some terms which involve the background geometry, so they're physical, right? And then I've got these extra pieces floating around, okay? So if I pull everything together and reorder it, rewrite it a bit. So what I've done here is kind of pulled the pieces together in a slightly different pattern. These two are the same because H is symmetric. These two you see are just symmetrized on A and B. These are, of course, symmetrized on A and B, and I've pulled the terms that I'm not too sure about, the first derivatives of H, into one expression, which is given in terms of this thing I'm calling H bar, which is H minus a half trace of H times the background metric. So this thing up here in brackets is the equivalent of the curved space wave operator for the gravitational fields called Lichnerowicz operator. Yep, everything in the square brackets. So, before we sort of think about what that means, I just want to stop and say what we've done, and then ask, you know, raise some questions, things that we have to think about and be careful about. What we did was we took a background metric G, we added a perturbation H, we went through and looked at how the Ricci tensor changed. We've got terms in there that look reasonable. We've got the wave operator, which is what you expect to see if you're looking at free propagation of some wave function of some particle. And then we've got terms involved in the geometry. Again, that's quite reasonable to expect to see. And then you've got this piece here. So that final term is something that's perhaps less expected, and it doesn't really fall into something that's either, you know, a wave equation, the action of the background, or some source. And so what you should be thinking is gauge degrees of freedom. The second thing is that I just said you added a little h to g, but even that is not entirely an obvious statement, because what do you mean by small? Okay, so there are a couple of issues that get raised here, you know. You have to think about what that means, okay? And the other thing is, of course, gauge. So, if you've already seen this in flat space, you'll kind of know that what's coming is that the h-bar term is in fact something that we can remove by gauge choice. And so in GR, gauge choices are just choices of coordinate systems. That's all it means. And when I was trying to write down spherically symmetric systems, I talked about choosing coordinates. And I probably occasionally said choice of gauge rather than coordinate choices. So in the when you're trying to solve for a metric, you see this gauge choice in a sort of more obvious way. You're choosing a description of the system you're dealing with by thinking about, you know, sensible or clever coordinates. In general, it's a little different. If you want to make a coordinate change, if you do this infinitesimally, what you're doing, one way of thinking about it, is just sort of shifting your coordinates a little bit locally. And that's like just moving a little bit along a vector field. So the vector fields are like generators of coordinate transformations. So we used this when we talked about the Lie derivative. When we talked about the Lie derivative, I talked about going a little way along a vector field, a little way along the sort of curve you get by integrating the vector field, comparing, taking the vector, so you went a little bit along u, you looked at v at that point, and then you took the v value at u and pushed it forward along to compare it at the same point. So that was using this idea of a coordinate transformation. Though I tried not to be too formal, actually, at the time. So, under a coordinate transformation, the metric shifts by the Lie derivative along the curve that the defined by the coordinate transformation. So that's why you say if you've got a Killing vector, it corresponds to a symmetry of the metric. So it's saying the metric doesn't change along that curve. So given what we've just been writing down, g goes to g plus h, the coordinate transformation in general is going to generate a perturbation of your background. It's not a physical one, but it is a perturbation of the background. So, I've kind of dropped the delta because I don't want to be carrying it around. I'm now imagining size just being this small transformation here. So that's the that you can think of as a perturbation. It's a gauge, it's a non-physical perturbation, but it's still one of these H's. So if we now ask what happens to these extra terms that we have in that operator, then you see that this H bar is simply, you know, the symmetrized derivative of psi minus the divergence of psi. So if I take its divergence, so if you look here, what I've actually got here is another one of these Riemann identities. Which I can replace the derivatives with a copy of the Riemann tensor. So I see that for my coordinate transformation, the extra term in that Lichnerowicz operator, I can reduce to something which is just a wave operator plus a Ricci term if the Ricci term is non-zero. But then you kind of fish for some sort of knowledge from solving PDEs, and you say, well, actually, this is now a well-posed PDE problem. And so if my divergence of H-bar in my original perturbation is not zero, I simply add one of these coordinate terms to cancel it off. So I can choose a psi which solves . So you have an initial perturbation. Maybe it has a non-zero divergence of H-bar, but then I choose a psi to solve this PDE, and then I write I add that to my perturbation. So I'm basically doing a coordinate transformation to get rid of that extra term. So I can choose a gauge . So this is the usual gauge choice. You might hear it called harmonic, incorrectly called transverse trace free. But that's a legitimate choice of gauge. So now I've got my operator down to being something a little bit more manageable, and it's also something where I've got an interpretation of what's going on. It's a wave operator in which the geometry is also coupled to your perturbation, which is completely sensible in general in gravity. So finally, if I've done this, I need to ask, what are my remaining gauge degrees of freedom? Well, I can do a coordinate transformation. Which is going to preserve that gauge choice. So I can always do that coordinate transformation. In other words, as long as that sort of generalized wave operator acting on the vector field vanishes. So let's just think about what this means from our degrees of freedom. So in general, that's a system of n equations in an n-dimensional space. So there are going to be n solutions. So we know there are n solutions to that general, roughly speaking, there's n solutions. What about the original HAB? So H is symmetric. So it has n into n plus 1 over 2 degrees of freedom, n into n plus 1 over 2 independent degrees of freedom. So then I have to think, right, but grad A of H bar AB is 0. So that kind of is n constraints on my H. I'm sort of restricting myself to perturbations which satisfy this kind of divergence condition. So what that means is I started off with n into n plus 1 over 2 degrees of, yep. Well, I'm saying just as a general rule, it's n equations, okay? And as long as they're well posed, so generically, there will be n solutions. So I'm sure you could probably think of some very special case where maybe a particular equation, couldn't be solved either because you'd given bad initial conditions or something else was wrong with the system. But just in a generic case, if you write down a wave equation, say just of a free scalar, you would say, well, I can solve it, right? And so here you've got, because you're in a curved background, they're obviously all coupled, but it's still a system of, in this case, it's a system of n variables. So just in general, when you have n equations with your sort of physical boundary conditions, there are n solutions. So, so normally if you were solving a sort of second order ODE, you'd say there were two solutions, and often you throw away one because it's unphysical. So I'm kind of using that very rough argument, okay, in this context. I mean, it does actually work, but I'm just trying to get the details or the essence across for the counting. So I'm subtracting off n because I've actually constrained my h. So that's n into n minus 1 over 2. So I'll try and talk about this actually in the context of vacuum just to keep things a bit easier. So I've now got, satisfying this equation, I've got n into n minus 1 over 2 degrees of freedom, but I know that if this gauge transformation preserves my choice of gauge, and you can also show it solves this generalized wave equation. So I have n into n minus 1 over 2 distinct solutions to my system of equations, but n of those are gauge. So I end up with n into n minus 3 over 2 physical degrees of freedom. So this is not doing any sort of counting in flat space. This is having looked at it, keeping the background curved. And with a certain element of trust that I'm asking you to take on board about the number of solutions to the equations. I really talk about degrees of freedom here. So, what does that mean? If we're in four dimensions, then 4 times 1 over 2 is 2. And so what this translates to is what you call this, a sort of plus and a cross polarization for the gravitational field. So this one is where, the plus one is where you, if you had a circle transverse to the sort of direction of propagation of your gravitational wave, it would do this. So you'd have that sort of sequence of moves. And the other one, the circle, would sort of squash in a cross. So those are the sort of the polarizations of the gravitational wave. In 5 dimensions, well, it's 5 times 2 over 2, so you've got 5 degrees of freedom. So here you have a sort of plus and a cross in sort of two mutually orthogonal planes. And then it's kind of a sort of plus a, like a diagonal mode. Alternatively, that you it's just one of these things that the number of degrees of freedom of the massless particle in one dimension up is kind of the same as the number of degrees of freedom of a massive particle in, you know, that dimension down. So in four dimensions, massive gravity has 5 degrees of freedom. And so the other way of thinking about these is as longitudinal polarization modes. So just like the photon has 2 polarization modes when it's massless, if you look at a massive vector particle, it also has a third mode, a longitudinal polarization. So it's the same sort of thing. So this sort of tells you about the number of physical states of gravitation in whatever number of dimensions you want. So in particular, in 10 dimensions, it's 35 degrees of freedom. So in perturbation theory, if you're just looking in general, it's actually often a problem to isolate those physical degrees of freedom. So I'm not sure, those of you doing cosmology, I don't know how much you've done on perturbation theory, but again, in perturbation theory in the universe, one of the problems is isolating physical modes. So quite a lot of work was done in trying to get gauge invariant perturbations. But the example that I want to talk about of stabilities or instabilities of some of these Kaluza-Klein black holes, it's actually not a problem at all in distinguishing the physical degrees of freedom, just because of the way the whole problem actually crumbles. So I'm not going to do the full calculation, but I'm going to at least give you a hint about how you might go about doing it. Maybe we can set it for the final homework. I was only kidding. Okay. Okay, so I wrote this down a while back as an example of how you could extend four-dimensional solutions to higher dimensions. And this is where you've got something which is Ricci flat in four dimensions, and it just happens to make it, by adding a flat extra dimension, it makes it Ricci flat in higher dimensions as well. So in this case, you can split the perturbation into a scalar mode, now again this is something that can be kind of confusing. It's a similar terminology used for cosmological perturbation theory. You tend to hear it saying the scalar perturbation, the vector perturbation, or the tensor perturbation, when what you're talking about is a perturbation of gravity. And therefore, it's always tensor, right? So why this description? Well, the reason is that here, what you've got is something where everything's going on in this subspace, this four-dimensional subspace. And so, from the point of view of the background metric, and so it actually makes sense to take your five-dimensional tensor perturbation and decompose it with respect to the way it transforms under this four-dimensional, this subspace, under the symmetries or the local symmetries, general coordinate transformations of this four-dimensional space. So the H55 transforms as a four-dimensional scalar under this, the four-dimensional part of the space. So this is what that terminology means. It's not saying that there's anything scalar about a metric perturbation. It's saying it with respect to some subspace. Right, so why on earth would we bother to look at the stability of this object? It's sort of black holes, Schwarzschild black holes are known to be stable, so why would you possibly expect an instability? Well, let's think about the thermodynamical properties of these solutions. Here's the one I've just written down. Suppose we've got compactification on a scale L. Here's our radius. Then the entropy of this object, S, is going to be the area, 1 over 4g times the area. Now, I'd like to also pick off what the mass of this is. Here I've written it in terms of the usual Schwarzschild way, but notice I put that gn there. That's emphasizing this is four-dimensional gravity. So but of course, what I've got here is G5. And so in order to get, G4, I actually have to divide G5 by L. So remember when we did the Kaluza-Klein reduction, we had an integral of r, root gr, r5. When we integrate over the fifth dimension, we pick up a factor of L. So that changes our Newton's constant between four and five dimensions. So that gives me my entropy in terms of, if I want to replace for r plus, so it's proportional to m squared. On the other hand, I could imagine having a five-dimensional black hole. We wrote down what those solutions were. So I wrote down what the five-dimensional solution was. And in this case, we know that the mass is related to, remember it was r plus over r to the d minus 3, so that's squared if the dimensionality is 5, and the mass is given in terms of those numerical factors times the square of the generalized Schwarzschild radius. Oh, there's a d minus 2 in there, isn't there? So it's 3. So that's the area of the 3 sphere is 2 pi squared, because it's really the volume. And so, hopefully I've got my maths right here. So I see that the mass is related to the square of the Schwarzschild radius. And the entropy, of course, is the same. It's same relation. It's 1 over 4g times the area of this horizon, which is 2 pi squared r plus cubed. So one has an entropy going like m squared on L. The other one has an entropy going like m to the 3/2. And also root g5. So that means that the entropy is scaling in a different way with the length of the extra dimension. So if we say that we want the masses to be the same, whether they're tucked into a string or into a black hole, then we look for where the entropy of the black hole becomes bigger than the entropy of the string. So obviously if I fix the mass and send my length to infinity, this entropy is going to drop. So it's going to tend to zero, whereas this one doesn't change because I fixed the mass. So in other words, at very large lengths, you'd expect this to be the preferred object. On the other hand, for very small lengths, that one is going to be the preferred object. God, it's a mess, isn't it? Keeping the factors, though, I don't know why, because all I really want is and so in other words, if L is bigger than if I got L, it should be L squared there, shouldn't it? No, this is L. I've lost a root L somewhere. This is embarrassing. Ah, I know where it is. So I've got L being bigger than some factors which I think end up coming up to be some factors of pi, which I'm just going to ignore for the moment, times g5m to the 1/2. But of course I just said that g5 was g newton times L, and so if I square this I end up with L being bigger than these factors times gnm, or in other words, something related to the original Schwarzschild radius of the black string. So this is telling me that when the size of my compactified dimension becomes bigger than the Schwarzschild radius, or reasonably bigger, I think I actually got the factors, this is 27 pi over 8, then I get an instability. So this actually makes some sense, because if I think of the compactification length as being smaller than the Schwarzschild radius, then how would a sort of black hole fit into the extra dimension? If I make the length very long, then this string is quite skinny with respect to the compact dimension, and so it's maybe not so unreasonable that it would prefer to squash up and form a black hole. And so what you actually do, I mean, that's just a sort of suggestion. Entropy arguments will tell you that the black string is unstable. But to actually prove it, you look at that perturbation equation, and I'll just write down the one for the scalar. And you kind of assume it's going to be periodic in the extra dimension. It's going to be an instability, so it's going to be exponentially growing. And then you're looking for something with no angular dependence. So I've written down what it is for the scalar mode, but what you see is essentially that this Lichnerowicz operator of HAB kind of splits into a four-dimensional Lichnerowicz operator plus a mass squared term. So you're doing something which looks like four-dimensional massive gravity. Now, you can look at this equation for the H55. So as R tends to infinity, this V is just the Schwarzschild potential. And so you see that you've got something which is H double prime plus H equals 0. So H55 goes like E to the plus or minus omega squared plus mu squared R. So this is what I was saying about picking out solutions. Here you would pick out the exponentially decaying mode. And then as R goes to 2gm, so whenever you're presented with some wave equation, you usually try to separate variables. You want to separate it using the symmetries of the background, in this case time and Z translation invariance. So that's why you've got the Fourier modes. You're looking for an instability, so you make it an exponentially growing mode. In this case, I'm kind of telling you that that occurs just as an S wave, so there's no angular dependence. If I look at this scalar wave equation here, what you then do is you look at the radial eigenfunction, you expand it at the two ends of your physical range, you pick the solution that is regular, and then you ask, can I take the regular solution at this end, the regular solution at that end, and make them meet? If I can, bingo, I've got an instability. Now, in this case, it doesn't actually work for the scalar mode here, because if you look at something coming, which is dying off at the horizon and dying off in, at infinity, then somewhere in between, it's got to have a maximum, which means that H primed is zero and H double primed is negative. Whereas, if you look at this equation here, if H primed is zero, H double primed has to be positive. So it's not possible to solve that equation. So there's no scalar mode instability, but, and there's no vector mode either, so no vector either, but when you look at the H mu nu, you find that there is a solution, and because it's a solution to this massive mode, you know it's physical, because any gauge solution would be a solution to the massless Lichnerowicz equation. And so what you see when you look at what the instability does is it makes the horizon ripple. And then it was just recently shown by the person who I think is taking the numerical relativity course that if you follow that instability through completely, so not just doing linear perturbation theory, but doing full GR, you actually see that the horizon, at least insofar as you can tell from numerics, does appear to actually break up. So here's something where in higher dimensions, so in four dimensions, horizons are very stable. They also don't want to disappear, okay? Whereas in five dimensions, it seems like, you know, that you can construct things for which suddenly a horizon starts behaving in a very different fashion. So I want to stop. Is the coffee machine working today? Yay! Excellent. So you all need a coffee. For the tomorrow, remember, tomorrow's lectures are both, the last two lectures are both tomorrow at 9 and 11:30. And what I want to do in those two lectures is to look at other ways of hiding extra dimensions. So I'm going to be talking about brain worlds and warped compactifications. So that's sort of to finish off the course. And I'm well aware that at this point, you know, right, it's going to happen in all the courses. You've kind of been trundling along the runway, you know, sort of sitting as a passenger and more or less following. And I'm afraid, I'm warning you, I am going to kind of start taking off in the last two lectures. So, but hopefully it's interesting. Okay. Any questions?
Snigger from the back.
I still have an anti-aircraft gun.
Yeah.
Can we discuss whether the eBay is more?
Oh, sorry. Yes. So, okay, the back of all is fine. What do you mean by small? Well, in the context of this problem, what you do is you look, or one way of doing it is to look at the components of age. If you go to one of these orthonormal bases. So that's one way of evaluating whether the perturbation is small. You kind of go to an orthonormal basis and say, H is small in the orthonormal basis. However, if you've got coordinate singularities, you have to be rather careful. And in this case, of course, precisely where the effect is most interesting is a coordinate singularity. So in practice, There's quite a lot of sort of dotting I's and crossing T's here. What you have to do is you use those, well, you can either use those Eddington Finkelstein or better, Kruskal coordinates. And then you look at the future, you know, the event horizon, the future event horizon,
and you say, right, my perturbation has to be regular on that, and, you know, small in with respect to a local orthonormal frame, which you can do now because your coordinates are regular there. So that's what you do in practice in that example. So it's kind of one of these things that's dependent, I suppose, on the particular application. But a fairly good way of doing it is to look in an orthonormal basis where the coordinates are regular. That's fairly reliable. Yes? Yeah, what about, where did I get it from?
Multiplying it by something, or is it, I don't know where.
So this is a power, if you look at this equation here, if you, I mean these should be GNs actually, I've just kind of forgotten that going through. So this is, if you thought about, R minus 2 GNs going to zero, right? So you've got a double derivative, single derivative over something going to 0 to the power 1, no derivative, something to going to 0 by the power 2. When you see that pattern, you immediately are led to try a power law solution. Your h is proportional to r minus 2gn to some power, n. You then pop that in here, you're going to get an n into n minus 1 from the second derivative, an n from the first derivative, and then that gives you a quadratic for the power. And I've written down the regular solution to that quadratic on the right-hand side. So these are standard techniques for looking at, in this case, this is an ODE with two boundary points. You simply look at an asymptotic expansion near what the singularities, near where the endpoints of your system, and you look at the regular solution that's there. So that's, you're sort of saying, well, I know my solution, if it exists, has to look like this at the horizon, it has to look like that at infinity, and therefore can it do that while solving that equation? For this particular mode, the answer is no, and it's fairly easy to see that. But to see that you get that the answer is yes for the tensor mode is a bit trickier. So, but I hope I've sort of illustrated the general idea of how you tackle these problems. Okay, I think I better stop.
This is called the Gregory Laplan.
No, I didn't say that.
Yeah, it's made of planet orbit, get some magnet. I don't know the story exactly, but you do.
Right, so yeah, it was myself and Ray LaFlamme, who's the director of the Institute for Quantum Computing. So we kind of, we did this sort of more or less when we were research students and a bit after. So, yeah.
It does have a name.
Just have a name, yeah.